Okay, who knows what to eat anymore? I mean, you know what you want to eat.
I want a burger
There you go.
right now.
You know what you should eat, probably a salad. But then there's what can you afford to eat? What do you have time to make? And the confusing, shifting landscape of nutritional advice and sales pitches. Reading food labels is almost like reading tea leaves. Do you see what you want to see or what the marketers want you to see? Maybe food without a label is the best food for you. Just the plain old food, like an apple, for example. No label on it. All of this is digested, pardon the pun, in Michael Pollan's new book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, a follow-up to his critically acclaimed The Omnivore's Dilemma. And Michael joins us in studio. Hey, thanks for making the time.
Sure, Allison.
I
good
know
to be
you're on
here.
super book tour, so we really appreciate you coming in here in person. Now, the advice on the book cover is very plain. I applaud you for putting all of the advice. You didn't wait to the last page. It's right on the
No,
cover.
I boiled it down to 7 words.
Well, okay, you tell me what they are.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
There you go. Segment up now.
Mostly burgers? Is that what you said?
Well, you
Mostly
know, I
burger, I
did
think
say
it is.
mostly. I didn't say plants. And in fact, I think you should have your burger. I think you
Thank
should
you.
just, you know, see if you can find a grass-fed burger.
Yes.
Much, much better.
I've had grass-fed beef before.
Well,
I love it.
It tastes better, and it's better for you, and it's better for the animals. It's a much less brutal existence for the animal. There is an animal involved in a burger.
Wait, what?
Yeah. We forget.
Exactly. I have to confess, now it's burger talk. I wasn't going to say this. I was reading your book at my favorite little joint in Manhattan, Tavern on Jane, and I was eating a burger while I was reading it on Sunday, and I thought, am I rebelling? I can't decide if I'm just rebelling about this or if I'm following your advice, because it was a burger on a whole wheat bun with lettuce and tomato. And one of the things you talk about is actually eating real whole foods.
Which that is. I mean, I do think that is real food. I mean, I'm kind of trying to get people to relax a little bit about it. I think there's a lot of obsessiveness going on around food these days. And there's a new eating disorder that's been diagnosed by some shrinks called orthorexia. People with an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. And I think that we're getting that way as Americans. We talk about nutrition a lot in our food. We all know what an antioxidant is, or we think we do. Cholesterol, fiber, all these nutrients have become lingua franca for us, which is kind of weird because people ate well for thousands of years without knowing what an antioxidant is or having ever heard the word. And as I looked at all the nutritional literature and the science, I realized it was simpler than I thought, and that the science itself is very sketchy, in fact, by and large, and that if you ate food, you'd be okay.
One of the things I thought was interesting is, though, it seems like this focus on nutrients actually came from what seemed like an originally a good idea to try to combat malnutrition.
Very well intentioned. We started studying nutrients because, yeah, in some cases there was a shortage of nutrients and people were suffering from deficiencies around the turn of the last century. And then we had this concern about heart disease beginning after World War II. So we started learning about cholesterol and saturated fat. And you know, science needs nutrients because it's very hard to study a whole food. You can't do a study on a carrot.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. I got so into the conversation that I realized I looked up at our clock and we only have 28 seconds left. We need to take a quick break. We're going to talk to Michael Pollan for the next 10 or 15 minutes or so after the break. We also have a lot of your questions that you posted on our blog. Stay with us here at the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. More of our conversation with Michael Pollan about his new book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Everybody, we're talking to journalist Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, about his new book called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Let's get back to the three statements on the cover.
Eat food.
We talked about eat food. Basically, eat something that your grandmother would recognize.
Yeah, the problem is it's gotten hard to recognize what's the food and what are the edible food-like substances that are coming to substitute for food. And that's where it gets confusing. So I try to develop a few rules of thumb. And one is don't eat anything your grandmother or great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food, which is kind of a mental exercise. You know, you're wheeling down the aisles with your grandmother in your mind and, you know, she
What
picks
was your
up,
grandmother's name?
Harriet.
Harriet with Harriet.
With
Edna,
Harriet.
Edna.
Edna, okay.
Leone.
Okay.
And you get to the Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes, and she picks up a box of those. Is she going to know what that is? Is she even going to know how to administer those tubes to her body? You know, no. I mean, it's not food. And you look at the ingredients and you find it's got, you know, 10 ingredients that have nothing to do with cows or bacteria, which is all you should find in yogurt. And so that's one rule of thumb. Another is if you want to eat food in the supermarket and avoid the edible food-like substances, just cruise the perimeter and stay out of the middle.
I love that. But I was going to ask you about that. Explain that to me.
Well, every supermarket is designed the same way, mm-hmm. almost everyone, and such that the real foods, the whole foods, the produce, the meat, the fish, the dairy products are arranged around the periphery for reasons having to do with refrigeration and access. This is where the biggest turnover is. Mm-hmm. And all the processed junk is in the middle, in those canyons of packaged goods. You know, the cereal bars and the sodas and the mixes and the home meal replacements, the TV dinners, all that stuff's in the middle. And if you stay along the edge, you're not going to get into much trouble eating overly complicated foods.
Now, the difficulty comes, the whole foods on the outside can be more expensive.
Yeah, that's right.
Can take longer to prepare. Mm-hmm. So if you're a mom, single mom with three kids on a fixed budget, is this advice really even feasible for you?
It takes, there's no question, it takes more resources, both time and money, to eat well. We have made a trade-off in this society between cheap food and convenient food and our health. And if, you know, processed food doesn't take much time, and it's true, the average American is spending only about an hour and a few minutes every day on all food preparation, all food eating, and all food cleanup. But this deal, this outsourcing of our food preparation to corporations, has failed us. I mean, we're very sick because of the way we eat. We're dying because of the way we eat.
So all the health trade-off, maybe all the money you're going to have to spend on your health.
Well, exactly. We're spending less on food. We're down to about 9% of our income we spend on food, which is less than any people on Earth any time in history. It was when I was a boy, in 1960, it was 18%, so it's fallen in half. But in that same period, the amount we spend on health care as a percentage of national income has gone from 5% to 16%. So cheap food isn't really so cheap.
Right.
You're really just kind of pushing the ball down the road. It'll catch up with you in some ways, you know. In terms of price, the fact is we have to address our agricultural policies if we want to deal with that. We're subsidizing the cheap junk food, fast food calories with the agricultural subsidies for corn and soy and wheat. These are the building blocks of the fast food nation. We subsidize high fructose corn syrup in this country. We don't subsidize carrots and broccoli. So we need some policy changes to make healthy food more accessible.
It's interesting you start talking about the policy changes. I was going to ask you for an example of something that I could pick up in the supermarket that I would see the hard work of a lobbyist.
Anything with high fructose corn syrup, mm-hmm. You know, breakfast cereal, sodas, anything with sugar, basically. Mm-hmm. They fiercely defend sugar. When the WHO, the World Health Organization, tried to issue some guidelines on what's a proper amount of sugar in the diet, they came up with 10% of calories. And the sugar lobby in America, which includes the corn lobby, went crazy. And they enlisted the Bush State Department to threaten funding for the WHO if they would not up these recommendations to 25% of daily calories.
Whoa.
So they're pushing sugar in a big way, and because we produce too much corn, and the corn gets turned into high fructose corn syrup.
Well, what about the things on labels that don't necessarily seem like they, I mean, you can look at corn syrup and sugar and think like, oh, yeah, I know this is bad for me, but I'm going to eat this anyway. Versus you look at something that tells me now that I've got omega-3s in here now, and there's flaxseed oil and all these things, which I think I'm supposed to eat to be a healthier person. Like, I'm trying to make a good choice here.
Well, you know, it's about this, what I call nutritionism, this kind of ideology, this obsession with knowing all these words. And, you know, if you eat whole foods, you will get plenty of omega-3s. You will get plenty of antioxidants without even having to think about it. So, yes, omega-3s, we think, the current scientific wisdom is that they're very important fats. And it's now, there's always a blessed nutrient and a satanic nutrient. And right now, omega-3 is the blessed nutrient. And now the satanic nutrient is trans fats. The new satanic nutrient, mark my words, will be omega-6. We will soon see a rash of omega-6 free products because this is thought to be a negative.
What is that? I'm sorry. I have no idea.
You know what? You don't need to know.
All right.
Just put your money on it.
It's another fatty acid that competes with omega-3 for the attention of your enzymes.
Ah.
And you want the omega-3s for your mental health and your anti-inflammatory properties. You don't even need to know this.
Mm-hmm.
All you need to know is if you eat food, as we have been doing for thousands of years, you will get whatever you need, whatever your body needs. And you don't need to take supplements. And you don't need to know what an antioxidant is to live a long and healthy life. You just need to eat fruits and vegetables.
The next thing on the title of your book, eat food and then not too much. Now, everybody knows you go to certain restaurants, you get a meal the size of, you know, yeah. Dinner plate the size of your head.
It's amazing.
We all know this, right? It makes sense. You put too much fuel in and it stores in your body as fat.
Yeah.
But how do you decide what is too much? I mean, it seems subjective.
Well, it is. You know, cultures, one of the things I did in this book was try to put the science over here and look at other forms of wisdom we have had over time on how to eat. Because, you know, historically people have figured out these questions without the scientists. And culture has a lot of guidance about this. And I looked at how other cultures dealt with the not too much problem. And before, you know, after scarcity was over. And they had a couple interesting ideas. The French do it with portion control. They don't buy those big plates. They only own small plates. They have a taboo, a social taboo against seconds. You know, you serve your first plate and you never go back for more. We just, you know, pass the dish around again. They don't snack. I mean, snacking, I think, is if you look at the additional calories we're eating since 1980, we're all eating about 300 more calories since then, mm-hmm. per person per day, which is enough to make you pretty fat. Most of those calories come in the form of snacks. The industry's done a very good job of colonizing every part of the day. We used to have these three meals. Now we're up to four eating occasions, 20% of which takes place in the car. So they've gotten us while we're driving. They've got us while we're watching television. And the only time they haven't gotten us is when we're asleep. Because they're marketing to every – and if you take Ambien –
there's somebody working on it right now.
No, think about – remember those Ambien takers
oh,
who woke up
–
yeah, so they figured that out too.
Yeah, people who were
sleepwalking
to the refrigerator.
That's right.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I know.
And binging.
Whoa.
And not even knowing it when they got up, except they saw there was no food left.
Except they had killed their lunch meat.
Oh, exactly. Oh. Exactly. So snacking is, you know, there used to be, when I was a kid, there was a taboo on between meal snacks. This was a phrase you heard. I mean, it's gone. So one of the things is to eat meals at tables. Don't take seconds. Avoid snacking. And you will suddenly find you're not eating too much.
We're talking to Michael Pollan. His new book is called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. And I'm sure you recognize this. NPR listeners, pretty smart group.
Mm-hmm.
So we put on our blog, we have a very active blog and website that you were going to be on the show, and we received many questions. Can I give you a couple?
Can yeah,
I run
please.
A couple by you?
Yeah.
Will G wrote, why do many Americans think that organic foods are superior to non-organic foods? Is there anything to the greenzo argument that organic foods are more nutritious?
Actually, there is. There's been some very interesting studies in the last couple of years comparing organic and conventionally grown foods, same species, same varieties grown side by side, and they have found higher levels of many nutrients in the organic. The thinking is that the soils are healthier, and if you have a healthy soil, you're going to have a more complex, chemically complex plant that will have more of these defensive compounds. The other theory, which is very interesting, is that most of these good things in plants are defensive chemicals to help the plant ward off disease and bugs. And if you're not spraying insecticide, the plant has to defend itself, so it produces more of these good chemicals. That's the other theory. But yeah, there is some evidence. Whether it's significant enough difference to justify the cost difference is another question.
People are very interested in you personally as well.
Okay.
From Andrea, does Michael Pollan have a junk food guilty pleasure?
Well, I do. I have a weakness for Cracker Jacks and corn chips. And I know, given I've railed about corn publicly for years, that may sound a little perverse.
There's an executive of Frito-Lay right now rubbing his hands together maniacally.
Somebody wanted to know what you're going to have for lunch.
I am going to an Italian restaurant. And I was thinking I might have pasta.
Are people frightened to ask you over for dinner?
Yes. I am convinced that since I started writing about this, I get less dinner invitations. And because people feel that they have to serve me this ethically correct food. But, you know, there are many values in life. And the social values of hospitality, which is to say you don't reject something people serve you at mm-hmm. dinner, is also powerful, as much as you want to look out for the health and welfare of the animals that you're eating. So I'm actually a very eager eater, and people should have me over.
And you're also about the socialization of eating. That's a big part of your book as well, that we've lost the pleasure of eating. You're always striving to eat a certain way to accomplish a certain goal.
And there is this obsession with getting it just right, whether you're a vegetarian or an ethical carnivore or a flexitarian, whatever you are, it becomes a very antisocial thing. Because you are, you know, you go to someone's house and you say, I'm sorry, don't eat that. Or the host has to say, can I make you something special? And suddenly the communal pleasure of everyone eating out of the same, you know, serving dish, sharing a meal, is lost. And eating is not just about health. Eating is about pleasure. It's about family. It's about community. It's about identity. It's about ritual. There are many, many reasons to eat besides advance, you know, living longer. And that really should be a byproduct of eating well and eating happily. And stressing out about food is not very good for your health.
Jay wanted to know, at what point in our history was the American diet at its very best?
You know, the American diet has never been very good. You know, you look at 19th century accounts, and we were eating way too much, way too fast. Europeans would come over here and get disgusted at the way we ate. We
just
and they still do. It's true. Our Puritan inheritance made it very hard for us to take pleasure in food. Like sex, anything that connects us to animals, as Puritans, descended from Puritans, we were very uncomfortable with. So eating was just about fueling up. And we didn't eat very well. We ate, you know, tons of bacon and all sorts of pork products. So I don't know that there's a golden age of American food that we could turn to, or what it would be. And that is one of our problems. Hmm. We don't have a food culture that we can fall back on the way
not
the
a
French
history
do.
To look at. Or...
Yeah, or the Italians. And we have to build one now.
Why didn't European eating traditions come over with...
I think in part because we had too many different groups here, and so there was no dominant one, and there was an effort to make scientific eating, even in the 1900s, the American way, and that was a way not to have any immigrant group be in charge, and it was also a way to tell immigrants, don't stop eating those messy sauces, start eating like Americans. I mean, the Anglo, you know, the British approach was the most dominant, and that wasn't a very good one. So we moved toward these scientific ideas of eating that turned out not to be very helpful.
Mike, we got about a minute and a half left, and you know, I like to think that I'm a pretty good interviewer type person, and I'm sure many people who have interviewed you think the same thing. But there's something in your book that nobody's picking up on that you'd like to talk about. Is there?
Oh, is there? Oh. No, except that, you know, remembering pleasure as a very important part of eating, and that it's not, you know, you're a junk food junkie and you enjoy food, or you're incredibly scrupulous and careful and you don't enjoy food. I mean, the fact is the more I've spent a lot of time studying the food chain and looking at how our food is produced, and I know the whole dark side of the American food system, but I enjoy eating more than I ever have before, because when I eat something in the, you know, that grass-fed hamburger in the full knowledge of how that animal lived, and the food chain that produced it, the sun feeding the grass feeding the cow feeding me, that's a very pleasurable thing to me. And we shouldn't lose track of that.
Michael Pollan, In Defense of Food, is the book. Thank you for coming into the studio. We really appreciate
it. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the Bryant Park Project for this Tuesday morning, January 8th. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for being here today, Daniel.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Are you coming back tomorrow?
I am coming back tomorrow.
Excellent. We hope you come back tomorrow. And in the meantime, visit our blog at npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. See ya.